From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, more Idaho Matters right now. So how prepared are you for a cyber attack? In this digital age, cybersecurity preparedness is a constant battle, and our only defense against hackers trying to steal our information and our identities. Well, that's a question that Toby King considers every single day. He's the Chief Information Officer of CapEd Credit Union, and part of his job is to train people on how to keep their computers and their phones and all of their personal information safe online. He'll be speaking at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Boise State on April 25th. We're lucky enough to talk with him now to get a preview. It is really nice to have you on the show, Toby.
Thank you, Gemma. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's just jump straight into cybersecurity. First off, why are automatic updates so important? And I know that might sound silly, but there is a reason for it.
It is. They're very important. And probably the most important reason is there is something called a zero-day exploit, which essentially is a vulnerability that's discovered in an operating system or software, and there is no patch for it provided by the manufacturer. So it's typically something that's discovered to be that is actively being exploited out there on the internet. And without patches, you never know when you may become the target unwittingly of such an exploit.
Okay, so these automatic updates, these are those updates for like an operating system, like on our computer or on our phone. I mean, I see it, like I'll get one like on my phone and it'll be like, your phone's going to update tonight, like automatically update. That's what you're talking about.
That is what I'm talking about. And most of the time when a manufacturer becomes aware of what in terms of its criticality, the riskiest thing that may befall your computer or your device is that zero-day exploit I referred to. Typically, once the manufacturer, whether it's Apple, Microsoft, or whoever, learns of it, they scramble their resources to create a patch, and then they deliver that as soon as it's available.
Okay, so let's talk about firmware updates. First off, just tell us what firmware is.
Yep, so firmware is the embedded operating system or device application that performs some function on a device. So it's different than a piece of software that you interact with on a daily basis. Firmware is the control mechanism, for example, that is within your wireless printer.
Okay. So then how important are these firmware updates? And I'm thinking in particular, at home.
Yeah, so firmware updates typically are not quite, they don't rise to the same level of importance as operating system or application updates, because the firmware is not typically available to somebody over the internet. That being said, it can be very important to update firmware, because even if someone is not trying to get to your system over the internet, you never know if your neighbor, they're trying to do some kind of rogue activity. And if you don't have proper protections for your own home wireless network, it is possible that that person may gain access to that device.
Okay, this might sound like a really crazy question, but I want to know if this is a myth or real. Is it true that hackers can like take over something like your coffee maker at your house?
Theoretically, it is true, but if it's happening, I'm not really hearing much about it.
Okay.
There have been instances specifically with a very widely deployed baby monitor a couple of years ago where, unfortunately, there was a default password that most home users who bought these things did not reset. And because this device was constantly essentially making outbound connections to a server on the internet, people out there were actually able to view what was happening in people's homes.
Has that been fixed? And I asked this just anecdotally. I mean, I have a sister that has an almost 2-year-old, and she was like, "We did not buy that monitor. Have you heard about this?" But I mean, that's really scary.
Right. I think companies, especially that specific company, but companies are learning from these kind of incidents because they get such a black eye in the media when these things are discovered. So I think that they're really trying to provide more information to consumers when they buy these devices. That it is critical to change the default passwords and so forth.
Okay, can we talk about phishing scams? First off, for folks who maybe aren't familiar with what they are, what are they and do they actually work?
So they definitely do work. Phishing is the number one method by which information is stolen off of home users' computers, also corporate users. But essentially, a phishing email, it looks to be typically a spoofed email. So what that means is it appears to come from somebody that you know. And if somebody really is targeting you, like say Gemma, and they know where you work and they know what your behaviors are, they can craft an email to look so legitimate, especially if they have information about you from maybe a public social media profile or something, or information that's been stolen through many of the different hacks that take place on a routine basis. So they could send you an email and say, you know, click here to look at the latest pictures of your best friend's baby, for example. So you think, oh yeah, you know, my best friend did just have a baby. It's nothing raises red flags to you. You click on that link and boom, you've installed something that allows someone out there, who knows where in the world, to be able to essentially command and control your own home computer.
So how do you defeat a phishing scam?
Well, you know, it sounds overly simplistic, but the number one way is to simply very carefully look at an email, even if it appears to be legitimate. And then before you click on any links or open any attachments, simply send a message to your friend, text them, call them, whatever, send them an email and ask, you know, whether or not they truly sent that to you. It said that the number one rule is if you're not expecting an email, then that should itself raise a red flag. It sounds a little bit paranoid, but in this day and age, you can't be too careful because this is the means by which people are stealing information.
Oh no, I have to tell you, there a couple of months ago I was doing something and I was inputting some information for a company, and that company calls me and they have all this information about me, and I was like, who are you? Like, oh, how do you have this information? And I'm not giving you any more information you need. You know, I sounded so paranoid, and they were legitimate, but they were actually very nice and very professional. And we're like, okay, here, you know, we'll set, you know, we'll give you this, do that to verify everything. And so can you talk a little bit about that, Toby? I mean, like, if it is legitimate and you are going down that paranoid path, I would think this is something that these organizations, like, let's say, for example, a credit union where you work, you're going to know how to walk someone through that process, right? So that they know it's legitimate.
Absolutely. So the number one thing to be on the lookout for, whether it's a bank or a credit union or your healthcare provider, when somebody is contacting you, and this almost never happens for the record, but if for whatever reason that there was a breach, let's say, and the company is actively trying to contact its consumers, that effectively they already have your personal information. So they should never need you to repeat back in full, for example, your social security number or your bank account number. They already have this information. So effectively, they could read out a redacted, a partial piece of information about you, some kind of personally identifiable information or what's called PII, and you can confirm it that way. So that way you could say, yes, you know, they're legitimate. But really, these sort of organizations that have this very sensitive data about you, they don't need you to provide it back to them. So that should raise a huge red flag right there if you're ever being asked about something like that.
Okay, so repeat that again, though, that legitimate organizations, I mean, unless there has been some type of breach, aren't just going to call you up and
That
ask
is
for your
correct. They're
information.
not going to call you up. They're going to either send you a text or send you an email that just simply tells you that there has been some sort of compromise. And if you would like more information, that you could contact them. And that way you're calling the actual real phone number or you're clicking on, you're going to the website that you type in yourself. That's the way that companies, organizations communicate with their consumers. You're not ever actually going to have someone verbally call you one-on-one and then, you know, attempt to have you verify very sensitive information.
Okay, let's talk passwords. Because I hate these big long password managers where, you know, they come up with the password instead of you. I do
Yes.
it, but I hate it because then you can't remember them.
I'm
but they
with
are
you.
better, correct?
They are better. So the number one rule is the longer the password, the better. In this day and age, actually, most security pros recommend that people use passphrases instead of passwords, especially if you have spaces and you write out a sentence and it has spaces, for example. the longer it is, the longer it's going to take some kind of a bot, you know, a program running a routine that tries to come up with every combination under the sun and to spit out what the password is. It tries, you know, every single combination. Well, a passphrase, not only is it, if you're coming up with your own, not only is it easier to remember, but it has the spaces in it and it is something that is very long. It's always better to have something that appears in plain text as a passphrase than something that has a bunch of substitutions, but that is short, because that's going to be able to be cracked much more quickly.
Okay.
And then one follow-up there is,
yeah,
whether or not you're coming up with a passphrase on your own or you're using some very long convoluted thing like you referred to, the best solution really as an end user is to use a password manager, so that you're not writing these down like in a book and you're not having to remember them. And especially if it's something that needs to be updated from time to time, you can actually put an expiration date on it and then be reminded by the password manager application that it's time to change it.
Oh, okay. So how about something like locking your phone? You know, some people don't do this. Is it important?
It is very important, because especially if you're using, for example, iCloud's keychain and Apple's iCloud keychain function, where it saves all your passwords. And if you don't require a PIN to actually access the device and you don't have Face ID turned on, it is possible that somebody could gain access to whatever is needed to authenticate as you. And then who knows what kind of level of access they have. It really depends on what sort of pass-through things you've set up on your phone.
Well, and you mentioned Face ID. So I have that on my phone, but nobody else in my family has it on their devices. But what's hilarious is my kids will grab my phone and then they'll stick it up into my face, right? And I'm like, you know, if you put it too close, it doesn't work. What are your thoughts on Face ID? Because I love it, actually.
Yeah, I love it as well. I mean, biometric is not absolutely bulletproof. There have been theoretical exercises where someone has taken like a silicone, you know, fingerprint or a silicone impression of someone's face, mm-hmm. actually, and been able to fool it. But that is something that is typically in the realm of very sophisticated entities. Your average person out there, you know, unless they're targeting the CEO of a Fortune 100 company, they probably don't have the resources or the motivation to do that. So, you know, if biometric is an option for you, and these days it increasingly is, highly recommend people take advantage of that.
What about an antivirus program? Should folks be using one of these, and are they safe?
So whether or not it's safe, it depends on whether or not it's legitimate. You, of course, okay. don't want to install something that is suggested to you free on the internet. But if you have somebody in your life who does know of a free application and how to properly configure it and knows that it's legitimate, I would say that is, you know, definitely on the table. But as far as whether or not you should use one at all, an antivirus program, as it historically was known, isn't typically that effective these days. But where it has gone to, it has gone to sophisticated endpoint protection applications. And so it's not just looking for what are called signatures for a virus anymore or a piece of malware, but it's actually looking to see what type of activity is whatever this thing is that has come down the pike onto your computer. What is it trying to do? And ideally, it's able to kind of run it in a sandboxed environment within the company's cloud-based environment, for your own end user system runs it. So to determine what kind of damage it may do. So you still need to have an anti-malware type of an application, but it's not just specific to viruses anymore.
Okay. I believe that you've talked about this previously, and this is about freezing your credit. Can you talk about that and why, I guess, should we be doing that?
Absolutely. So it's really tedious, I will tell you. I mean, anytime I go to apply for a loan or whatever, I have, of course, have to go and unfreeze it temporarily. But that being said, this is the other than, you know, potentially healthcare information where somebody wants to try to defraud the government via that method. Typically, the reason that personally identifiable information is sought after by criminals is because they want to be able to open up credit cards in your name and those kinds of things. So if you freeze your credit, that can't happen. Your person cannot open a credit card. They cannot take out a loan. Essentially, any, you know, bank, credit union, et cetera, is not going to be able to get anywhere if they cannot pull your credit.
Okay. And you say you should do this at what, the three big credit bureaus?
Yeah, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion are the big three.
Okay.
And the federal government is actually
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
The federal government has made it easier to do this in the last couple of years. So I don't have the link just off the top of my head, but I will provide it during my presentation next week.
Okay, great. And then before I let you go, I swear, this seems like a losing battle. These cyber criminals come up with all kinds of ways to steal our information. But if we do these things, how realistic is it that we will, hopefully keep our information safe?
Yeah, you can only do so much. You can have obviously more control of your home environment. These days, mm-hmm. of course, so much information is stored in cloud systems now that the security is really as good as the cloud provider is, has somebody minding the store, so to speak. And so there are breaches all the time. Some are publicly made known, many are not. And, if a person were to go on the dark web and look for information about themselves, I think a lot of people would be surprised at what is already known about them, which is kind of scary. Anyways, sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there. I hope I answered your question.
No, that's okay. It's just a matter of, I think it can be really overwhelming just as an average person when it comes to all of the ways that you can get hacked. But, can we at least, by doing these things, try to keep our information as safe as possible?
Absolutely. There are a number of measures that you can take as a consumer, as a citizen, to protect your information. Whether or not some other entity that is housing your information then gets that compromised, that's out of your control. You could drive yourself batty worrying about it all the time.
Yeah.
It's the nature of the society, the age that we live in. It's the information age. And there's no getting around having your information out there. So it's really a matter of what kind of backups and what kind of safety protections do you have in place for when, not if, that information about you becomes compromised.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about this. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to actually speak to you. I've heard your voice so many times in my vehicle.
And now you got to hear it in person. Well, I really appreciate the conversation. We've been talking with Toby King, Chief Information Officer with CapEd Credit Union, talking about cybersecurity preparedness and the need for it. He will actually be speaking at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Boise State. That'll happen on April 25th. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I have never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.